Good afternoon and welcome to BICOM's weekly Hadyun podcast. I'm Richard Pater, the director of BICOM in Israel. I have Kalev Ben-Dor, the director of BICOM's research team, also based in Israel with us. Kalev, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Richard.
And we're delighted we have a guest with us today, the pollster Simon Davis from Number 10 Strategies, a political consultant and pollster who has worked on dozens of campaigns across the world and in Israel with Israeli politicians and others, who is going to kind of shine a light for us on various aspects of the polling as we draw very close, less than a week away from the general elections here. Kalev, do you want to start off?
Sure. Simon, you know, I've been following the polls for a long time. BICOM, we've been trying to aggregate them. But I think not a lot of people really know what goes on the other side of the polling from the pollster's perspective. Can you just kind of shine a light on the process? We know that X amount of people are asked their opinion, but what happens after that? What does the pollster do with those numbers and figures?
So firstly, thank you very much for having me. I think the first thing to say is that the polling that we see in the newspaper and online is only a very small fraction of what's really going on. Generally, what we're just seeing is ultimately how many seats the poll says that a particular party is going to get. But the actual numbers behind that could be very different. And there's a number of different aspects here. Firstly, if you're doing a poll, you might not necessarily get all aspects of the population. For example, if you're doing an online poll, you might get a lower percentage of ultra-Orthodox, you might get a lower percentage of Russians, and you might get a lower percentage of Arabs and various other groups that are underrepresented. And then generally what you'll do is you'll weight the numbers. So you'll give a slightly greater significance to the people from that demographic that did answer the poll, in order that in the end, your sample becomes reflective of the population. There's quite a complex process in between asking the question, getting the answers, and what's actually publicised. That's one aspect of it. The second aspect of it is that, especially in Israeli polls, you always get a very neat 120 seats. And the numbers will be very different from that because, firstly, a good chunk of people will be undecided. And those undecideds in Israeli polls just get taken out of the sample as if they didn't exist. I'll give you an example from not in Israel, a campaign that I've been polling for recently, an election that's a while away. I did a poll recently that showed our candidate, I think, 45% for our candidate and 35% for the other candidate, with 20% undecided. In the public polling, which showed a similar result, that's reported as 57% for our candidate and 43% for the other candidate. 57-43 looks like, you know, the election's done and dusted. 45-35 with 20% undecided looks like a very, very different election. And all the public polling's done is they've taken out the undecideds and worked out the percentages that way. But that gives a very, very misleading, I'd say, picture.
With regard to the undecided vote, we've seen reports in the Israeli media over the last day or two. Haaretz had a report telling us that 16 seats of the 120 were actually undecided. Israel Hayom said similarly, 18 seats undecided. How do we quantify those unknown votes? And how's that going to relate to the election that we're talking about?
So from the public polling, from the information that's widely available, there's no way of knowing, because it's generally not reported. In a campaign poll, you might ask anything from 30, 40 questions to 100 questions. So you'll ask a series of questions that will help you to understand who the undecideds are, where they stand, and then you can work out roughly if the majority of the undecideds are on the left, for example, then that's going to have a certain influence on the election. In Israel, it's generally assumed that the undecideds tend to be centre-left. And the other thing that's true all over the world is someone who's undecided a week out is less likely to actually go and vote than someone who's decided. So those are two factors that are influencing the undecideds. Or not influencing them, but influencing, indicating their impact on the race. So we don't know whether they'll vote. The likelihood is they're less likely to go and vote. And there's an assumption that generally the undecideds will be on the left. This year, I'm less certain about that because traditionally what you've seen is a lot of centrist and left-leaning parties and people wavering between them. This year, actually, if you look at the polls, the centre and the left, there's only three parties that are being talked about, really. Kahol Levan, Blue and White, Labour and Meretz. And actually, it's on the right where there's a huge amount of parties and splinter parties and so on. So it might actually be that a lot of the undecideds have a different profile this year.
The last polling is going to be published, I think, tomorrow. And throughout, there's been this idea that blue and white are leading, but it will be easier for Likud to get to 61. There have been a couple of polls in the last couple of days that show perhaps that trend's actually changing and Likud is now actually in the lead over blue and white. What do you think the polls do well, that the polls that we get to see, and what do they not do well, in your opinion? What's lacking from them?
The best thing the polls can do is they can show you generally trends. There's a huge amount of polls in Israel. I guess there's an average of one poll a day, I would have thought, that's being publicized over the last couple of months. And from that, you can identify trends. You can probably say today, I'd probably say that blue and white and Likud are probably both around the 30 seat mark. Roughly, you know, it's pretty much a toss up there. You can see that there's a couple of parties, not many in the middle bank, probably you'd say the Labour Party, Chadash, and around 8, 9, 10. And then the rest are really flirting with the threshold, somewhere between 4 and 6. All of that you can see from the polls. Beyond that, I wouldn't read too much into what we're seeing in the public polling, because I think once you've seen the other side of it and you've seen all the data that campaigns do have and serious in-depth polls, one becomes a bit sceptical of sort of 1-2 question public polls that are produced very, very quickly. And I'd be naturally cautious about making too many predictions based on them.
Do you have a sense from the polling that you've done of kind of what the critical issues are, how would you prioritise what people care about the most here coming up to next week?
I think generally in polls in Israel, when you ask the biggest issue, people will generally answer the economy. But I think when it comes down to voting, speaking not as a pollster, but just as an observer of Israelis and the way elections have gone, people tend to vote on security. And again, I think this is where slightly more in-depth questioning that the campaigns will have access to, you can really probe people's feelings and hopes and fears in a much deeper way than the sort of the general question that you'll see in the polls of which issue will have the greatest influence on your vote. And you'll generally have a choice between security, diplomacy, possibly the economy, and maybe religion and state. The other thing, just by the way, in terms of how you identify these things, is a whole aspect that we're not exposed to in the public, and that's focus groups, which have an equal, if not greater, impact on the way campaign strategy is built. And in focus groups, the campaigns are really probing particular target voters on every issue under the sun to work out exactly how they can reach those groups and exactly the impact that their messages are having on those individuals. And that's a whole nother sphere that certainly in Israel, there's no, I know sometimes in the UK they do, media outlets do focus groups and put them on YouTube. And in America, there's an element of that. But in Israel, there's no culture of that at all. So that's another aspect of giving us the picture. So in terms of the issues, to come back to your question, generally polling will show that the economy is the biggest issue, but I think when it comes down to the ballot box, security generally trumps all.
Just in terms of the focus group, Simon, do you think there have been messages, either blue and white or Labour or Likud, that we've all been hearing that you think are a result of serious research in terms of focus groups?
As a political professional, I would hope so. Yeah, I'm certain. All the parties in Israel are doing serious polling, serious focus groups all the time. The fact that there's a criticism of Israeli public polling, I don't think is reflected in the polling that the parties are doing. I think the parties are doing very serious research. All major messages, I would have thought, will have been tested in polls, in focus groups. Adverts that you're seeing will have been tested in focus groups. Literally showing adverts, showing dummy adverts that are made that never see the light of day if they don't go well in focus groups. All the messages that we're exposed to some extent, are tested.
So as we're a few days away from the elections, perhaps Caleb, I can start with you. Would you like to make a prediction for next week?
Would I like to make a prediction? I'm not sure I'd like to make a prediction, but I mean, as I said, we've been doing aggregated polling for a long time. Again, with the thing that Simon said, that the data we've been exposed to is relatively superficial. I think Likud has been consistent at around 28, 29 seats. Blue and White has also been consistent at one or two seats more. I've been seeing that from, you know, aggregating over the last 2 or 3 weeks. But I think our analysis really is that the key is not at the top. The key is at the bottom. And you've got a number of smaller parties, one Arab party, Balad Ram, several right-wing parties, Israel Beitenu, Kulanu, I guess, is a centre-right party, Gesher is centrist, maybe Shas even as well, who have been close either side of the electoral threshold. And I think what will determine the election will, less than the amount that Likud and Blue and White get, will actually be which of those smaller parties ends up passing the electoral threshold and which of them do not. And that is something that at this stage it's I think, impossible to know.
Simon, are we able to put you on the spot and ask you for a prediction?
I think I agree with everything Caleb said. I would add, in terms of who will get more seats between Likud and Blue and White, I think that's very much a toss-up. I think the huge advantage lies with Likud and with Netanyahu in terms of forming the next government. There was a poll done, I'm not sure who, possibly by Channel 2 here a week or so ago, which is quite an instructive question that I always like to ask. They asked, irrespective of who you're going to vote for, who do you think will be the next prime minister? And I think something like 60% said Netanyahu and 20% said Gantz. And I think there's a certain wisdom in that, that irrespective of who gets the most seats, certainly Netanyahu has an advantage. It's not a done deal, but that I think is the direction it's going in all likelihood.
Okay, well, Simon, thank you very much indeed for joining us today on our last podcast before next Tuesday's election. We very much appreciate your thoughts and insight, and thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard, it's very easy with all the election focus to forget that there are actually major national security issues going on in the country as well. I think on last Friday, we discussed with James what was going on the Gaza border. We were all quite concerned that things might escalate. What's been happening since then?
Well, thankfully, our very pessimistic and concerned assessment that we could be on the brink of another major escalation thankfully didn't come to pass, largely thanks to, ironically, thanks to Hamas, that proved that they are in control to the extent of the flames. And what we saw on Friday, and particularly on Saturday, when they were marking the year anniversary of the Great March of Return, as they see it, and Lands Day as well, is that thousands of Palestinian officials wearing fluorescent orange vests kept the crowds back away from the fence, basically adhering to the 2014 understandings reached after Operation Protective Edge, that meant that a few hundred metres on the Gaza side of the fence would be a no-go zone. The Hamas officials kept that up, and that really prevented any major hostilities and, thankfully, fatalities. There were three Palestinians killed, but compared to what people were predicting and suggesting, then it was very much a calm day. And since then, I think credit needs to go to the Egyptian mediation efforts that have been going on for the last few months, but have stepped up and seem to be particularly productive over the last few days. Just yesterday, we saw another announcement from one of the Hamas senior leaders calling on Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the other Palestinian armed factions to stop floating these balloons with incendiary devices on them and stop the nighttime protests that include throwing explosive devices at the soldiers, etc. So with that coming to an end, and obviously we also saw Israeli measures earlier this week as well, expanding the fishing zones to the largest zones that we've seen probably in the last 15 years or so, and agreeing to increase the supply of electricity and potentially of other power modes as well to improve the lives of regular Gazans. So this is still in an early stage, and the Egyptians are carrying out shuttle diplomacy between, obviously there are no direct talks between Israel and Hamas. But the hope is that these things will reach an understanding and that they can form some form of long-term quiet. I think then after the elections, there are even more impressive plans underway from the Israeli side to also increase exports out of Gaza and to increase potential permits. All of this also is limited to the extent until we have the return of the bodies also from summer 14 and the two Israeli civilians that Hamas hold.
Yeah, I mean, I think my feeling is that there is short-term quiet now, which is great, but the structural issues surrounding Gaza are going to make it difficult to really kick on from there. I mean, just, you know, the prisoner issue that you mentioned, I think that's going to be very, very difficult to resolve. So I think we're at a stage where a limited agreement for short-term quiet has been achieved, and that's really great. My feeling is even after the elections that the sides will struggle to build on that. But, you know, we can only be hopeful that they'll find a way.
Well, that's right. And just as we are looking ahead of the elections, Hamas are also following these elections very closely as well. And this time next week, we'll know more about the potential shape of the future government. And we can speculate who the next defence minister will be and what line they will take. And that will also have a great impact on where these talks go. So we will certainly revisit these subjects in the future. Caleb, as ever, thank you very much for joining me. And thank you all for listening. And we look forward to speaking to you again after the elections.